From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. The impact of today's technology on our children goes far beyond video games and computers in the classroom. With some technological advances comes the unexpected potential for injury. Conversely, other technologies can dramatically improve some children's lives. For over 25 years, Paul Brodeur has been a staff writer for The New Yorker. His four books on asbestos have won major awards and were instrumental in making the public aware of its dangers. In his book, The Great Powerline Cover-Up, he turns his attention to electromagnetic fields. We'll discuss health problems and the groundswell of citizen action associated with this man-made phenomenon. Later, we'll take a look at genetically engineered growth hormones. I'll speak with Dr. Neil Shulman about his new book on this subject and with Brent Carney, a 12-year-old boy who has taken human growth hormone for the past 3 years. Paul Brodeur's latest book, The Great Powerline Cover-Up, speaks from both the experience of communities throughout the United States as well as the findings of scientific studies. I asked him why daily and constant exposure to electromagnetic fields is not healthy for the human animal.
We evolved as human beings in a direct current magnetic field on Earth. But only in this century have we been exposed to 60 hertz alternating current. That means current that vibrates to and fro 60 times a second. That's how our whole electric distribution system works. And as one famous oncologist said recently, and as most scientists know, when you're standing beneath a high voltage or high current power line giving off strong magnetic fields, every molecule in your brain and body is vibrating back and forth 60 times a second. Well, now that's never happened in human evolution, and it doesn't take an electronic wizard or even a medical doctor to figure out that in the long term, day in and day out, with chronic exposure, that may not be very good for you. And in fact, there are 60 human studies, most of which illustrate that it is not only not good for you, but that it causes a statistically significant increased cancer in children and adults exposed at home or at work to powerline magnetic fields.
Now, we're not talking about just walking through this once a day for a minute.
No, because whenever you talk about occupational or environmental disease, whether it's exposure to asbestos or to chlorinated hydrocarbon pesticides or chemicals, you're almost invariably talking about long-term chronic exposure. Now, the electric utility industry's been trying to scare people and drag a red herring through this and obfuscate this issue by pointing out that appliances, many home appliances, give off strong magnetic fields, and in fact, they do. If you take your hairdryer, for example, and put a Gauss meter, that's a device for measuring the magnetic field, right against the housing, you'll get a strong magnetic field. But because of the size of the coil in the appliance, when you pull the measuring device away an inch or two, the field drops off drastically. But even more important than that, you don't hang out with your hairdryer 8 hours a day. You don't sit on your vacuum cleaner, and you don't curl up to your electric toaster or coffee maker. We're talking, you know, we're all exposed intermittently to asbestos, to chemicals, and of course to magnetic fields from appliances, mostly our fingertips. What is the problem here are devices that expose you long-term and chronically. The power lines, when they are built close to schools or to homes or to offices, either high voltage or high current power lines, they give off strong magnetic fields that invade those homes and offices and schools for 24 hours a day. And there are a few things that you have to be careful about. You have to be careful about your video display terminal, but if you sit an arm's length of fingertips extended from that, you're not going to have a problem because the magnetic field doesn't extend out further than that. And the electric blankets, which were a big problem, they're almost out of sight now. I mean, they've been withdrawn from the market or they have been redesigned.
You tell the story of the effects of this exposure by looking at a number of real stories. Let's start out with the story of Meadow Street.
Well, after I wrote my initial book, I'm a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, have been for 35 years, and after I wrote my initial pieces on the power line problem, which were the first major pieces ever written in 1989, and they became a book called Currents of Death, I, I got about 5,000 letters and phone calls over the next 3 or 4 years from people who were concerned about this or that. And many of them were from people who were concerned because they lived on streets like Meadow Street, which is only 200 yards long, has only 9 houses on it, where there was extraordinary amount of brain cancer. You have 5 or 6 brain cancers in that street, as well as other cancers. And it's a very stable population. It was a blue-collar street in a little town in Guilford, Connecticut. And people didn't move away, and there was a substation on the street. The substation is where high voltage comes in. You understand that high voltage is the, you want to think of electricity as water in a garden hose. Voltage is the pressure that pushes it across the countryside from the nuclear generating station. But you couldn't bring that high voltage into a city, because if you did try to bring it into a building, you'd burn everything up. So you have to step it down at transformer stations called substations. And the transformers actually transform the voltage into current. Current is the juice that goes out on high current distribution wires and then spreads out in this great vast spider web of the electric distribution system with low current wires. And where your problem is with the high voltage wires coming into your cities, or with the high current distribution, the trunk lines really, that send out the high current from the substations. It's not with the low current wires which comprise most of the distribution system. Well, on this Meadow Street, there was a substation. High voltage was coming into the substation, and right along this little street within 30 feet of these houses went some very high current distribution wires that were supplying current for a distant load area for 30 miles up the coast. So these people were exposed to the magnetic fields given off by all the current that was supplying a huge load area, thousands of homes. So there were very strong magnetic fields. And wherever you have this situation, whether it's in a school like the Slater Elementary School in Fresno, which is within 100 feet of a 115,000-volt power line, and you've got 15 cases of cancer among the teachers and administrative personnel on that one side of the school and none on the other, or whether it's the Montague Elementary School down here in Santa Clara, 35 miles from San Francisco, where you've got high-voltage lines near the schools, or whether it's across the country, in North Carolina, where you had people who lived in the factory town near the Duke power plant, they have an extraordinary incidence of brain cancer. You're going to find increased leukemia, lymphoma, brain cancer, breast cancer in men, which is a frightening thing because of its implications for women, and I'd like to talk about that later. You're going to find increased incidence of cancer of all types, probably, but especially those, because the experimental studies clearly show that the magnetic fields suppress the immune system. They suppress the ability of the T lymphocyte cells, which are the soldiers of the immune system, to combat cancer.
Now, are children especially susceptible?
The Swedish government, which has acknowledged a year ago, almost to the day, that power line magnetic fields are a cause of cancer in humans, believes that children are especially susceptible. And the 8 or 9 studies that have been done in this country and around the world, studying the exposure of children in residences close to power lines indicate that they are susceptible, and it's only natural. Here you've got this agent, the magnetic field, an invisible line of force, vibrating 60 times a second. Everything in its path, nothing can shield it, goes right through concrete, wood, anything else, and of course the human body. All the molecules of the human body will be entrained to that rhythm, vibrating back and forth 60 times a second. In a child, his cells are dividing so rapidly, particularly the hematopoietic cells, the blood-forming cells and the brain cells, you can imagine that this simply would affect them. It stands to reason. Logic tells you so. But the utility companies, and unfortunately the state health departments of many states and the federal government, want people to think that the jury is still out on this. Well, that's absurd. There are 60 human studies done around the world, all of them published in the peer-reviewed medical literature. More than 50% of them are statistically significant increase of cancer. 80% of them show some association. Only 15% are negative, and of those 15%, almost all have been conducted by the electric utility industry. I mean, you know, wake up. It's there in front of you. The Environmental Protection Agency issued a report 3 years ago, our Environmental Protection Agency, stating that power line magnetic fields were a probable cause of cancer in humans. They particularly mentioned children. That means more likely than not. And since then, the Bush administration and now the Clinton administration has been trying desperately to suppress that information.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Paul Brodeur. He is author of the book, The Great Powerline Cover-Up, How the Utilities and the Government Are Trying to Hide the Cancer Hazards Posed by Electromagnetic Fields. What amazes me is the reactions of school boards and authorities. They say, we will take no action until the situation is unequivocally proven to be dangerous. Well, what about, these are our children? There are some findings and there's some common sense. We will not expose them until the situation is definitively proven to be safe.
Well, of course, this is ignorant, stupid. I mean, in my view, criminally stupid. But here's what's happening. Here's the reason for it, first of all. Your school boards, and I have had experience with them now in about 10 different states, say this to begin with because they talk to their lawyers, and their attorneys say, listen, fella, you close off these classrooms or you take any steps to acknowledge that this is a problem, a parent with a child with cancer or a teacher who's developed cancer or an administrator personnel can sue you, and the school board will be, the school district will be a target defendant. So just as with the electric utility industry, they want to deny this. And people, either the CEOs of the electric utility industry or the members of that school board, can't wait to just keep the lid on this until they get out of there, go on to some other job, until the responsibility leaves them. Now what's happening all over the country is that parents and teachers aren't standing for this. At the Slater Elementary School in Fresno, California, the parents and the teachers simply went before the school board and said, hey, listen, we've got too much cancer in the school. You're going to do something about it. And the school board said, yes, we should do something. And they closed down the school. They closed down that side of the school. They did the same thing at the Montague Elementary School in Santa Clara. They're doing the same thing back east in New York State, for example. Attorney General Robert Abrams ordered, or persuaded, perhaps, a better word, the utility industry, who directed them, really, to measure the magnetic fields at all of the state schools that were within 100 feet of high-voltage power lines. The authorities in New Jersey have done the same thing. Why aren't the attorney generals in other states doing this? It's a question of knowledge among the people, and that kind of pressure that comes from the people to the authorities. You see, if that pressure didn't come, the authorities would never do anything about this for one very simple reason. Once any state or federal health official acknowledges, as the Swedish health officials and government had done, that this is a problem, then they've got to do something about it. They can't just say, this is a cancer hazard, and then walk away from it. Well, they desperately don't want to do anything about it because they are afraid that this is open-ended. They don't know the extent of this problem. None of us do. It's got to be pervasive, it's got to be big, and it's got to be expensive. The Clinton administration, the Bush administration, openly tried to suppress the EPA report. Then they set up all these phony committees to review the literature and say that there's no problem. The Clinton administration has gone along with this. Vice President Gore, 2 years ago, asked the EPA to come to his Senate office when he was senator. They measured the magnetic fields there. They found a very dangerously high level there. Presumably something was done about it. In any event, we know, because it's been published, that Senator Gore took the measuring device home and measured his home. He hasn't said a thing about this since then, since becoming vice president, except that 2 months ago he went before C-SPAN, and he told people that according to the Bush administration science, Office of Science and Technology report, there was no problem. Well, there is a problem. The chapter on the human studies of that report was written by a scientist who's a paid consultant of the electric utility industry. And so this is where we are here, and this is why I've called my book The Great Powerline Cover-Up.
Why are the schools so much at risk? How could that have happened?
Well, interestingly, particularly in new states like California, not so true of New England where I live much of the year, but in California, for example, and in other parts of the country, school districts have always bought the cheapest land for their schools. And where is the cheapest land in any community? Well, for aesthetic reasons, it's always been near the power lines or next to the power line corridors. So in California, you've got schools, many schools, but in many other states too, not just California, built very close to power line corridors. In New Jersey, for example, I write in the book about schools in New Jersey that are sandwiched between huge high voltage lines. And the problem, of course, the medical problem is that here you're congregating children, which everyone agrees are most vulnerable to these kinds of fields, in classrooms where they're exposed for hours on end each day. Some of those children, God forbid, may even be going home to homes where they are also heavily exposed because the homes are next to high voltage or high current lines. So what we have to do in this country is behave intelligently the way I think the Swedes have done. First of all, we have to acknowledge that there's a problem. Then we have to identify where it exists in its most correctable and importantly correctable form, and then we have to set about to remedy it. I mean, that's what an intelligent human being does, when an individual does when he gets sick, or he or she gets sick. He or she says, well, I'm sick. I acknowledge that I'm sick. I go to the doctor, identify, get it diagnosed, where it exists, and then I'll follow the doctor's orders and I'll remedy it. We haven't even got to square one in this country. The state and federal health authorities are pressured by the utility industry and by the executive branches, because they're scared of the money, are saying, deny this. Deny this. Say the jury's out. Keep denying it. Don't admit that there's a problem. This is crazy.
Now, you have indicated that there is success at the grassroots level when there have been some very substantial problems that couldn't be denied at the Slater School, for instance, or on Meadow Street. If I'm a parent and I have a child in a school, how do I go about finding out the status of my school?
Well, first of all, you can eyeball the school and know whether it's close within 150 feet of a high voltage or high current power line. And if you think it is, then there are people who will measure all over the place. I mean, if you go to your school authorities and say, we want this school measured, they're going to have to do it, and they will do it. Sometimes there are problems in homes and in schools with wiring. That's not customary, but they can be easily resolved by fixing the wiring. As far as measuring in your home or school go, you always want to make sure that you measure with the current shut off as well as on, because when you have shut the current off, then you know for sure that whatever magnetic field reading you're getting in the school or home is an ambient field coming from the outside, i.e. the power lines, because there's no other source.
So one guideline for a school is to be sure that they have a measurement of the magnetic fields that are within the school, and then to determine if they are unacceptable, whether the source is wiring or an external.
Exactly, yeah. And Gauss meters are very inexpensive. That's the measuring device. I mean, it's in there, and a child can use one. You push a button, you get a reading. So it isn't hard to take a Gauss meter and get an approximate idea whether you have a problem in your home or your school. And as I said, there are people who are doing measuring professionally here in the Bay Area and elsewhere across the country, and they can be found in the Yellow Pages.
This is not a problem of the poor. Many times, lead paint, it's like poor people live in old apartments. A school in Montecito, California, which is an extremely wealthy community, had this problem.
Yes, this problem cuts across all socioeconomic lines. I have seen within a half a mile where you'll have high magnetic fields in a mansion and literally in an immigrant hovel. People didn't know about it. The homes, particularly in California, have been built right in the power line corridors, often with great vistas of the ocean down in San Diego County, where I live part of the year. And that's one of the reasons that the government is not going to succeed in keeping a lid on this. It's very easy to keep a lid on problems like the big pesticide problems in McFarland for years and years, or the Stringfellow acid pits, you know, until something terrible happens. But it's not so easy to keep a lid on the problem when, and this is the other edge of this double-edged sword of the electromagnetic field problem, when not only one's children and oneself are at risk of disease, but when one's home is being devalued. And the litigation that's out there now in California, across the nation, for property devaluation is probably what is going to turn this whole thing around. People will stand for a lot, but the middle class in this country, and I suspect anywhere else in the world, will not tolerate its most precious commodity, its home, from being devalued. I always thought that people's most precious commodity was the health of their children, until I wrote four or five books about asbestos disease over the last 25 years and realized that people often just are willing to forget disease. It's a sort of unthinkable. Anything can happen. Your children just, you know, deny it. But this business of not being able to sell a home, that's not so deniable, and people are really reacting strongly to that.
My guest today is Paul Brodeur. He is a writer for The New Yorker, and his work has earned him the National Magazine Award and an American Association for the Advancement of Science Award. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Paul, you wrote many books on asbestos, and we're familiar with how that became a major issue and affected the schools, affected people's homes. Are there similarities here with the asbestos situation?
Well, there are some similarities. One is a major attempt to deny the problem. But the asbestos problem was originally perceived of by the American public as an occupational problem, a workplace problem. Shipyard workers, construction workers, railway people, and asbestos products manufacturers and fabricators, insulators, these were blue-collar people who were dying at extraordinary rates of disease. It only became a major national problem when, once again, the middle class saw asbestos in its schools. And there was a huge hue and cry, and in 1986 the Congress passed laws mandating its removal. And now, of course, as you know, no architect in his right mind or construction engineer would use asbestos in any building in this country. There's been a de facto ban on it. So naturally, the industry has moved elsewhere, overseas to the Philippines, Thailand, India, and Guatemala, wherever, and Mexico, where, of course, the lungs of people are precisely the same as our lungs and where they're killing people wholesale. Now, you must remember that the asbestos problem was not resolved by the government, either the state or the federal government. What resolved the asbestos problem was the greatest toxic tort litigation in the history of world jurisprudence. There had never been anything like it before, and may never again until the power line litigation cranks up. You had tens upon tens of thousands of sick, dying, and disabled workers who could get no recourse from the state or federal government, because the state or federal governments, just as they are with the electric, with the power line magnetic fields, refused to really do anything about it and refused to take any preventive measures. So when the state and federal governments failed, health authorities failed to do their job, when the industry in question, as the asbestos industry did, denies it, stonewalls, people, the last recourse of the injured citizen is the law. So no one should be surprised that there was all this asbestos litigation. Now, of course, the system heals itself, and through the bankruptcy laws, these firms got out of paying what they should have, and the insurance industry did too, although, as we know now, Lloyd's of London is going belly up because of the $50 billion asbestos hit. My point is that the way we do things in this country, the way we deal with preventive measures to protect the public health, needs talk about the medical system needing redesigning. That's what needs redesigning in our country. The present administration quite correctly wants to deliver health care to the American people in a new way. I'm all for it. I think everybody is. But unfortunately, because of the economic considerations, it's got a case of myopia. Health care is not simply a question of affordable treatment. Much more important is prevention. And litigation does nothing to prevent disease because of the simple reason that by the time you can file a lawsuit, you've got to have a cause of action. You've got to have a child who's diseased, or you have to be diseased, or your home has to have lost value. That's no way to protect the public health. But that's the way we do things in America. And we've got to change that. And I think people are beginning to see that, particularly with this power line magnetic field problem, because, as we said earlier, it cuts across all socioeconomic lines.
In many of the stories in the book, in the various places in which we see this kind of problem, there is a constant discussion between the authorities and the citizenry who's concerned about whether or not there is a cluster. And the cluster, of course, means something artificial has happened to induce the cancer. One of the examples I'd like you to talk about is Slater School. One of the things that hit me there was they had twice the expected rate of cancer. This was explained by the person in charge as being coincidence. And then it occurred to me that when we're looking at expected rates of cancer, that in fact we're looking at how many cases in a general population. so that if you in fact have these artificial clusters of cancer, that the expected rate is actually much higher than that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Let me say about the Slater School is that the state health authority, California state health authorities, diluted their whole risk ratio by not taking the fact that all the cancers occurred on one side of the school. They assumed that there was twice what would have occurred in the whole school. But a simple sign test will tell you. I mean, when they say that this is due to chance, that's ludicrous. A simple time test will show you, and any mathematician will tell you, that the chances of all 15 cancers occurring on the side of the school next to the power line is 1 in 2 to the 15th, or 1 in 32,750-something. Now, the other thing about this is that one of the high state officials in California, when the Slater School thing was going on, went before the Fresno Rotarians. And he said, well, he said, that he quoted some studies that have been done in this country, the pioneering studies that showed that there was a 2 to 3-fold increased incidence of cancer in children who lived in homes near high current wires. And he said, and I quoted him, really, that's nothing that I would want to break into a sweat about. Well, first of all, that's a quintessentially ignorant remark for a public health official to make. But secondly, as any epidemiologist knows, if the risk is 2 to 3-fold in these studies, the actual risk is probably closer to 6 to 8 to 10 for one very simple reason. The studies do not compare exposed children to non-exposed children. The studies, all of them that have been done, simply compare children who have been exposed to more to children who have been exposed to less for the very simple reason that you cannot find a child in the modern industrial society who's non-exposed, or it's very difficult to. So in the case-control studies where they try to get children living in the same neighborhoods, the same areas of cities, either Denver or Los Angeles, where these studies have been done, they try to find them living, they do the case-control study. The very idea of the case-control study is that in order to weed out the other confounders of traffic or cigarette smoking or whatever else, you have to find children who are comparable, in comparable circumstances, so that if you take a look at the actual magnetic field measurements in these studies, you'll find that children in the high current homes who have the 2 to 3-fold risk only have a 2 to 3-fold risk over children in the lower current homes who nonetheless are significantly exposed. So if you were to take, in other words, exposed children to non-exposed, totally non-exposed children, you'd find a much higher rate, 6 to 8. So this idea of the utility industry and its apologists at the state and federal level is trying to say, well, you know, 2 to 3-fold, that isn't so bad when you think that only 1 in 10,000 children develops cancer and now it's only 2 to 3. It's much greater than that. Moreover, because the magnetic fields act as a promoter, probably not so much of a cause as a promoter, anybody who is prey to cancer because of say, another factor, say the children in McFarland, who we know were exposed heavily to pesticides, but you have this huge Voice of America transmitter, one of the most powerful radio frequency transmitters in the world there. Now, you don't have the kind of cancer that you had among those children, probably without some other factor. So you have to look at cofactors. You remember in asbestos exposure, cigarette smoking was a tremendous cofactor. The idea that there's only one thing that causes cancer is crazy. While we're on this subject, I think it's worth noting that 4 recent studies show that men who work in power line magnetic fields, power linemen, telephone linemen, electricians, electronic engineers, are experiencing a 6-fold increase in male breast cancer. Now, male breast cancer is a vanishingly rare disease. It afflicts in the United States 1 in every 100,000 men each year. But as everybody in your audience knows, it's not a vanishingly rare disease in women. Indeed, between 1 in 8 and 9 women are developing breast cancer in their lifetimes, which is extraordinary. It's an epidemic. Now, breast cancer in men is histologically identical to breast cancer in women when you put the tissue under the microscope. So it seems to me that it stands to reason that something that is causing a significant increase in breast cancer in men, and the 6-fold may be greater, as I've already indicated, should be of enormous concern to American women who are now demanding that the government finally do something about this extraordinary epidemic of breast cancer. It certainly should be looked at very seriously as an undoubtedly a probable cofactor in the development of breast cancer in women.
who is responsible to ensure what in the public health? Cities, states, federal government?
I'm beginning to think, after writing about these matters for 25 years, that you can't designate anybody, that what you have to have is a populace that is sufficiently sensitive to the fact that many outside agents can cause disease, chemicals in food, bad air, asbestos, etc. We know there are so many. Now the ozone layer, you know, that's going to cause incredibly increased skin cancer. 300,000 cases of excess skin cancer in the United States alone in the next 20 years, according to the EPA. And you'll never find the politicians or the state health officials who are beholden to politicians because they're appointed by them who are going to ever acknowledge anything. So it always requires an aroused and an enlightened, better word, enlightened citizenry to keep the pressure up. I think the pressure is going to be kept up because, once again, this cuts across socioeconomic lines. Blue-collar workers have always been expendable in all societies, but the middle class isn't, and we're a country that is dominated and run and motivated by the middle class.
There have been many accusations of irresponsible reporting generating mass hysteria. And whenever I see anyone accusing anyone else of generating mass hysteria, I always look at the accuser and I say, what do you have to lose? Who has what to lose over this?
Well, the electric utility industry, of course, because they've denied this so much, is now facing massive litigation. There are major personal injury lawsuits all across the country, and there are literally hundreds of property devaluation lawsuits growing by leaps and bounds daily. Major litigation will be filed next week in the Slater School case in Fresno, for example. So they have that to lose. As far as the accusations of sensational reporting, you know, I was called an alarmist and a sensationalist by the asbestos industry, of course, by DuPont and the other manufacturers of chlorofluorocarbons when I wrote about the ozone layer, by the electronic industry when I wrote about microwaves and radio frequency radiation. So it comes with the territory. You know, all of a sudden you're a sensationalist and an alarmist when you're writing about things that affect people's pocketbooks. The fact is that any reading will show that almost all of the great Powerline cover-up is written from the documentary evidence. For example, when a state public health official says that he was not going to break into a sweat about a 2 to 3-fold increase of cancer, I have the tape recording which he said that. When he says, or when another state official appears before in the Guilford Town Library with the utility and allows the utility to tell the citizens of the country, of the town, excuse me, that there's no problem on Meadow Street, I have the minutes of that meeting. And I have written this book out of that kind of documentary evidence. And when a journalist can write out the documentary evidence, he doesn't need to go and get the pro forma denials from the utility. I learned something many years ago, and I think most journalists know this. Whenever you want to know why someone is saying something or not saying something, or why someone is doing something or not doing something, you follow the money trail. It rarely leads you wrong.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest today has been Paul Brodeur. His book, The Great Powerline Cover-Up, How the Utilities and the Government Are Trying to Hide the Cancer Hazards Posed by Electromagnetic Fields, is published by Little Brown & Company. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Dr. Neil Shulman is a medical professor at Emory University. He is the author of the book, Understanding Growth Hormone, New Discoveries to Help Very Short Children. I asked him why short children are short.
There are a lot of different reasons why short people can be short. One is it can be genetic. Their parents can be short. Two, they can have some sort of abnormality that is inherited but may not be from their parents directly, a bone disorder or something along those lines. Thirdly, a child can be short because of psychological problems at home or in their environment. Fourthly, they can be short because of malnutrition. And fifthly, they can be short because of a disorder where they do not have enough growth hormone.
So how long have we been using growth hormones to treat extreme shortness in children?
Well, synthetic growth hormone has been around since 1985. And before that, they extracted it actually from the pituitary gland in the cadaver. In our books, we have a history on hormones and the endocrine system. And it's very, very interesting because hormones are just substances that are secreted or thrown directly into your blood by different glands in the body. And growth hormone is a substance that is put out by the gland, which is right at the base of your brain, called the pituitary gland. And what they used to do is just take the growth hormone from the cadaver of people, and they'd use that extract to treat very short kids. But that was quite dangerous because it caused some serious brain injury in certain cases. This has not occurred with synthetic growth hormone, which is not taken from a cadaver, and it's very pure.
They were using an enormous number of pituitary glands. I think you stated in your book over 80,000 human pituitary glands to treat just 3,000 children. That's like a 25-to-1 ratio. And the children who received that treatment contracted a disease, and I can't remember which one it was.
First of all of them didn't develop it, but some children did develop it. That does not happen at all with the synthetic growth hormone. The cadaver type of growth hormone is no longer available, so the fear of getting that disease is over because of this revolutionary way of actually making the growth hormone rather than taking it from cadavers.
It was in 1985, I believe, when the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, that was it, was present, and the FDA said, no, we can no longer use the naturally occurring growth hormone. And it was very soon after that that the synthetic human growth hormone was approved. I'm surprised at how quickly this new synthetic growth hormone was approved. Was it because they couldn't use the natural one anymore?
I think that probably had some impact on the Food and Drug Administration. I don't know the particulars, though. And, of course, the synthetic growth hormone, they've been doing research on it for quite a long period of time and had to go through a lot of studies to make sure it was safe and that sort of thing.
Profile for us the development of the synthetic human growth hormone.
The synthetic growth hormone is actually produced, it's very interesting, from bacteria. These bacteria actually are engineered to produce the natural substance. It's a bacteria called E. coli that does that. There was a guy named Cho Hei Lee, who was born in 1913 into a large family of scholars in Canton, China. He came to the University of California in 1935, and 3 years later, with a PhD in physico-organic chemistry, he actually started doing experimentations. And in a little small laboratory, this fellow Evans put Lee to work isolating the anterior pituitary hormones from animal extracts. In 1945, Li, that's L-I, isolated growth hormone.
Who is considered to be extremely short?
We call people extremely short who are at the 5 percentile level. In other words, at the outer extreme. In other words, the shortest 5 out of 100 kids. Generally, if a child is not growing, say, 2 inches a year, or they are not needing new clothes because they're just not growing, or they're the shortest kid in class. Those are things that can clue you in that your child might have a growth disorder.
Is shortness considered a disease?
If you're 45 years old and you fly into LaGuardia Airport in New York and want to rent a car, and you're so short that you can't see the person over the counter, and you're so short that when you sit in a car, your feet can't hit the pedals, then it's a handicap for you, because any place you go, you've got to take a cab or have somebody drive you around. If it's 2 in the morning and you want to go over to a bank teller and get some money out to buy some medicines, and you can't reach the bank teller and there's nobody around, it's a handicap to you.
So it's a handicap, but it's not a disease.
It's a handicap if you're just short. Now, if you're short, there are certain diseases that actually cause you to be short. For instance, Gary Coleman, you know, the actor, was very short, but he had kidney disease, and his kidney disease caused him to be short. So you can be short because of a disease, but you can be totally healthy and be short.
Now, anybody who is short, they are a child, are they going to grow taller if they take the human growth hormone?
No. If a child is short in growth hormone, he doesn't have enough growth hormone, then that can be a reason why he will respond to growth hormone. But it's a fraction of small children who were deficient in growth hormone. Now, there's another group of children who may also respond who are very short. For those children, there currently is a study underway to determine whether they benefit or don't benefit, and there's a bit of a disagreement among the pediatric endocrinologists. Those are special hormone doctors who treat children and who really specialize in this area, and some of them feel as though some children can be helped even if they have normal levels of growth hormone, and some feel as though they can't be helped.
I don't get the picture on the study here. I'm sorry. What is it
studying? What they're actually going to do, the National Institute of Health has a group of children who are very, very short and potentially would be disabled when they grow up because of this shortness. And half of them will get growth hormone and half will not, to see if the growth hormone will help these children. But they have normal, natural levels of growth hormone, but they're still very short.
So let me distinguish between the two types of symptoms. One is that you're very short, but you don't seem to have enough growth hormone for what we would expect. Therefore, we would presume that if you had what we would consider a normal or appropriate level of growth hormone, that you'll in fact start growing because you have an inappropriate level. Now, this new study has to do with children who are very short, but when we measure their growth hormone, we say, gee, that's in the appropriate range. Maybe you're just short. And so now it's looking to see if the human growth hormone can in fact help them.
That's absolutely correct.
Who determines the guidelines for what is an appropriate level of growth hormone?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a gray area right now as to what is the normal level. Some differences of opinion in that area by various pediatric endocrinologists. We have a lot of those areas in medicine. We call them gray areas of medicine, and you don't know the exact answer. Now, in most cases, it's not a problem because people follow the extremes. But again, it's like high blood pressure. I mean, there's some people who have slightly elevated blood pressure, and what that means, whether they should be treated with medications, is a whole different story. Mm. Well, the same thing goes with any other variable, just like with growth hormone. That's why they're trying to conduct this study at the National Institute of Health, is to find out in a more sophisticated way whether children will benefit.
How many kids are on this in the United States?
There are about 15,000 children that are taking growth hormone today.
What's the likelihood that this drug could be abused when treating children? I mean, what would happen if you gave a normal kid human growth hormone? I mean, how do we know we're not trying to breed tall guys who, because we think they'll be more successful?
Fortunately, the industry has put up a lot of safeguards so that the growth hormone is not abused. In other words, any physician cannot write a prescription for growth hormone. Only pediatric endocrinologists can. Even your regular pediatrician cannot write a prescription for growth hormone. Secondly, you can't go to your corner drugstore and get growth hormone. It's not available through drugstores. It's available through home health agencies, special companies that monitor its use very carefully. So it's actually harder to get than a narcotic.
Extremely tall people. Are they people who have an excess of human growth hormone?
Well, you could actually have too much growth hormone when you're a child and potentially become a giant. There was actually a report of one case where a child had too little growth hormone and he was a midget. And then he got too much and he ended up being a giant.
Do growth hormones work for bodybuilders?
There's some evidence that it may help. It's still questionable. It does increase muscle mass, but it's very dangerous to use for that purpose. And somebody who's not a little child, who's already grown and is trying to build up their muscle mass and taking growth hormone, it can be very, very dangerous.
While Dr. Shulman described for us the background of this relatively new drug, we thought it would be important to speak with a child who is currently undergoing this therapy. Brent Carney is a 12-year-old who lives in Georgia. For the past 3 years, he has been taking growth hormone injections, a synthetic version of the hormone which his body does not naturally produce. I spoke with Brent and with his mother, Mary Ann. I began the interview by asking Mary Ann when she first suspected her son might have a problem growing.
Actually, we had some suspicions when he was in kindergarten because he was so much smaller than the other kids even in the kindergarten class. And as each year progressed, it became really obvious that he was not growing very quickly at all on his own and was getting farther and farther behind the other children.
Was it just a matter of size or was it developmentally as well?
Just size. As far as anything else, intelligence or agility, that was all pretty good. Agility definitely was probably not as good as it could have been just because of the difference in size between he and the other kids.
At what point did you finally say, wait a minute, we need to do something here?
I had thought about it for several years starting in kindergarten, and finally in the second or third grade I spoke with the pediatrician we were using at the time, and they just said he'd probably take a growth spurt when he was in about the fourth grade, around 8 years old. And then we got to the summer before the fourth grade, and he'd been in the same size clothes for a couple of years almost. And I said, you know, something's got to give. And at the time, we switched to an HMO due to my husband's job. That was made available. And the doctor there was familiar with growth problems because she had done a residency with a doctor that had some children that were on growth hormones. So she sort of recognized there could be a definite problem based on growth chart and different things that I had told her. And that's how it all started. He's been on the growth hormones 3 years now.
3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Did they determine that Brent had a deficiency of growth hormones or no growth hormones? What did they do to determine that?
He was tested. It was a four-hour test where he was hooked up to an IV and they would inject him with L-DOPA was part of the test, and they would draw blood samples and then also insulin and draw blood samples. And both of these things, from what I understand, are supposed to really pump up the growth hormone-making mechanism. And in his case, basically nothing happened. It was so minute that you'd almost say he wasn't producing at all.
So in that sense, here we have Brent, who's a perfect kid, And yet he didn't have this growth hormone that would enable him to grow in a sort of a normal pattern.
Exactly.
What were the options presented to you at that point?
Well, really the only option was either to basically not grow at all, and his anticipated adult height without any growth hormone was about, I believe it was 4'6", which of course for an adult male is pretty small. The other option, of course, was to use the growth hormone, which involves taking a shot every day. One other test that we did have to go through, he had to have a CAT scan,
mm-hmm.
and that just to make sure that there was not any tumors or anything that were blocking the pituitary gland. But other than that, I mean, that was really our only options, either don't do anything or do that. There was no in between. So, of course, we opted to go ahead with the growth hormone shots.
How did you decide to go ahead? What worried you?
Well, we wanted to check on side effects and things like that. We talked quite a bit with the doctor and some other pediatricians, and I went to the library and did a little bit of reading on the growth hormone medication that he was going to be taking. And I just felt like that the statistics of any real problems were so low that we would go ahead with it. Well, my husband and I, you know, discussed it quite extensively before we made the decision.
How much did you involve Brent in that decision?
Well, at 8 years old, well, I guess he was 9 then, enough so that he knew what was going to be involved. And, of course, he was interested in growing because he was tired of being made fun of at school and not being able to reach things. And so he was, of course, nervous about having to take a shot every day. I was nervous about having to give him a shot every day, you know. but other than those concerns, you know, that was really the only concern we had.
Brent, what was it like to go through all those tests when you first you're looking at these options?
Well, it was kind of scary, but, I mean, after about one test, it wasn't that bad.
You got used to it, huh?
Yes, ma'am.
When this all started and you had to get a shot every day, how did you handle all that?
Well, I mean, I was scared. I guess any kid would be scared, you know, to have to take a shot every night. But after, I guess, about the first month, it was easy. Just like every night before I went to bed, I took a shot, and it takes less than 5 minutes.
Do you give yourself shots now?
Yes, I do.
How long have you been doing that?
I've been giving shots for about 2 years now to myself.
Do you feel any side effects from taking these drugs?
No, ma'am. When I first started, I got hot. That only lasted for a week or two. And now I'm fine.
Did you know when you were 8 years old that you were a whole lot smaller than your classmates?
Yes, ma'am, because I remember I couldn't reach the pencil sharpener in my class. I was so short. And everybody was taller than me. I was the shortest kid. So I remember it very well.
How did that feel, being so short?
I felt real bad, you know, because at the time my brother was even taller, just about the size as me.
And how old is he at the time?
He was about 4 or 5.
And he was the same size as you as 8 years old?
Yes, ma'am.
Marianne, let me ask you that question as well about, in the beginning, you had to get the shots started. Mm-hmm. How did you manage that?
Well, we were, of course, shown at the doctor's office how to do it. I don't think we actually did one at the doctor's office. But I just pretty much had to just buckle up and do it that first day. I mean, it was, and we had a chart, and you were supposed to go on the different sites every day. And so we were real careful with all that. And so it was, you know, it was a challenge for a couple of weeks. And then it became more routine. I gave them to him for about a year, and he's been doing it for 2 years now.
All right, Dana, did you teach him, or did he go someplace else?
I guess I taught him. I mean, he just started doing it. I'd sort of help him at first, and then he'd do it, and then he'd kind of do it a few days, and he couldn't do it, so I'd do it. You know, it was a process of probably about a month to really get him where every night he was able to do it. And at first, I would draw it up into the syringe, too, which I don't even do that anymore. I do mix it. It's two things that have to be mixed together, and I do that, which is, you know, I do that about once every week or week and a half. I mix up enough.
How much of this is covered by insurance?
Almost all of it. Since we're on an HMO, we had just gotten on one when all this happened, and the way our HMO is set up, we pay $5 a month for the drug, which basically is nothing.
Now, how much is the actual cost?
I would assume by now, based on the dosage that he's taking, it would probably run about $350 every 5 or 6 days. It's, you know, you figure around $20,000 a year, I think, at this point. So we're very, very lucky that we pay the $5 a month, and then we buy our needles, and, you know, that's it.
How much longer do you anticipate Brent will be taking the growth hormone?
Until his bones fuse, which usually is somewhere in around 17. It could be sooner, could be a little longer. I've even talked with the doctor a little bit about, well, hey, what if he's 15 and he's 6 feet tall? You know, are we going to be able to stop? And, of course, that's all just hypothetical at this point. We don't know. He's growing very well. We were just at the doctor Monday, and he grew an inch and a half in 3 months, which he had slowed down some, so we were real excited with that.
Now, from the start, when he started taking it at 8 years, what happened?
As far as his growth?
His growth,
Has grown 13 and a quarter inches in 3 years.
And where does that put him in the norm for his age group?
Average. He's right at 50 percentile.
Now, you and your husband, are you of average height?
I'm 5'6", and my husband's 6'2". So he is, the doctor has anticipated that Brent will be somewhere in between the two heights. So we're looking toward, you know, a 5'10 to 6 foot tall, probably, ending height.
There are parents out there who are in this gray area. Their children are very small, but are they too small? They don't want to have to put their children on any drugs unnecessarily, but they want to help their children in every responsible way. What advice do you have for those parents?
I would think the first thing would be obviously to go to the pediatric endocrinologist and have some studies done as far as their heredity, and then, too, possibly even taking the test I referred to earlier to see if the pituitary gland is producing the correct amount to grow. Generally, a child is supposed to grow about 2 inches every year. So if that's not happening, if the same size clothes are being worn a year or two, then obviously something must not be working exactly correctly. But if everything's working correctly, I don't know. I have mixed feelings on that. I know there's a lot of controversy on it right now. I don't think this should be given to kids just because somebody wants to make a basketball player. But, you know, if it's pretty well set in stone, the child is going to be way below even an average adult height. That could cause problems in the adult life, emotionally as well as physically. Maybe not being able to reach car pedals or high shelves, things like that. I mean, you don't want an adult to be so short that they're handicapped.
Did you see a difference in Brent's behavior or attitude once he started taking the growth hormone and once his height started moving?
Most definitely. A definite switch. I mean, he's always been a very well-adjusted child, but of course he would be quite down sometime because he was so short and was being made fun of. So once he began to grow, it really helped. And his fourth grade teacher was wonderful because he grew six and a half inches the first year. So she really saw him shoot up in the class, sort of was right there with him, you know, and just really encouraging and everything. So that really helped. So his ego definitely was built up by the fact that he finally was like everybody else.
You have another son.
Mm-hmm.
Has his height been impaired at all?
Not at all. No, he's I believe, in about the 60th or 70th percentile for height. So he's not involved in this at all.
Brent, has it all been worth it?
Yes, ma'am, it has. Now I'm average size of my class, and nobody makes fun of me anymore.
My guests have been Brent and Marianne Carney. Brent has been receiving daily injections of synthetic human growth hormone for the past 3 years. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.